this chapter that we're going to look at this morning, as you can tell from the very first words, it's a message concerning Babylon, an oracle, which could be understood as a burden, a declaration. It's the prophet's message, a spoken word to Babylon. And there's an emphasis in this chapter, as we'll come to see, on the day of the Lord. And we'll look at that. This chapter begins a section in the book of Isaiah that carries us at least through the 24th chapter. And in looking at this, we will not look at all the verses and passages as we've done much as we've come to this point. But it begins a section that reveals God's judgment upon the nations, upon the Gentile nations, and of course comes back to the people of Israel itself. What you have in these chapters, or especially in this chapter that we're looking at, is a prophecy that involves revelation. It's a prophecy that is looking to the future. Now remember that the prophet, you have to understand that the prophets were as much as anything preachers to the people and the occasions of their day, the time in which they lived. But within that, we have what we think of with prophets, people who are foretelling the future. They're telling events that they could not know aside from revelation. And what we have here is a vision then that Isaiah sees, and it's a vision about Babylon, and it's really a vision about Babylon's destruction. And yet, at this point in which he's dealing with this, the Assyrians are still the power, the mighty, the world conquering people, and Babylon is still yet to rise to that place under Nebuchadnezzar. And so here he's talking about the destruction of a people that's rise is yet to come. He's talking about their fall. He's talking about their judgment, when yet they are yet to rise to come. Well, the passage is about three things I think are really interesting in it, and to stand out as you look at it. And I'm not assuming that you've read the chapter. And we probably won't read every verse in the chapter this morning. I can pretty much guarantee you that. But the first thing I want to draw your attention to is the prophetic language that's used in this chapter. And I want to show you that Isaiah uses this type of language, and the prophets use this language, and then in the New Testament we come to use this language. And why is important to understand this and to begin to look at the Bible in light of this? It's really what the Bible teaches in the New Testament, in passages like Matthew 24. There is a prophetic language, the language that's used, describing the day of the Lord, the days of judgment. And it appears to be talking about the second coming. But it's not talking about the second coming. There are times that you just assume, if you're not careful, that the Bible's talking about the second coming of the Lord, when it's actually not talking about the second coming of the Lord. It's actually using language the way the prophets used the language. And just the reading of the prophets, we begin to see this. Look at verse 10, for instance, of this very chapter. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. Verse 13, therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth will move out of her place, and the wrath of the Lord of hosts, and in the day of his in the wrath of the Lord of hosts and the day of his fierce anger. He's talking about what you'll see in the constellations, the stars of heaven, the sun darkened, the moon not giving, causing its light to shine, the heavens shaken, the earth moved out of its place. The wrath of God has come. Just taken by itself, you assume that has to be the second coming of the Lord. Then you look at verse, where he says, verse 9, the day of the Lord comes. And verse 6, rather, the day of the Lord is at hand. Verse 9, the day of the Lord comes. Verse 11, I will punish the world for its evil. And then back to verse 13, I'll shake the heavens and the earth will be moved out of her place. All that, you look at that language, you're thinking, it's the day of the Lord. It's the second coming. It's the final judgment. It's the wrath of God being poured out. But it's not. That's not the first focus here. Because it's clear he's talking about the judgment of Babylon. Look at verse 1. It's against Babylon. If you look at verse 17. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, who will not regard silver. And as for gold, they will not delight in it. Now, if you're familiar with the history of the Old Testament, you know this, that the Assyrians were in power. And the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, they rise up. And now the Assyrians fall before the Babylonians. But then the Babylonians fall to the Medes and the Persians. You see that in the Old Testament. You see especially in the book of Daniel. Verse 19, and Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as one God overthrew, as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. The judgment of Babylon will be as destruction, as destructive, as when God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So it's very plain that although you have this language about the stars, the sun, the moon, the earth shaking, the heavens moved, and you have the day of the Lord, and all that's described, and yet he's not talking about the second coming of the Lord. He's talking in prophetic language, the language of the prophets, that this is going to be such a mighty destruction, it's like the world is being affected. Well, when you go to the 19th chapter of Isaiah, it gets really plain, this prophetic language. The burden, verse 1, against Egypt. Behold, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and will come in to Egypt. You see the Lord riding on a cloud and coming into Egypt. Now, the Bible talks about the Lord coming in the clouds, coming on the clouds. And when we get to the New Testament, we see this language. But here we have the exact same type language, prophetic language, where the Bible is describing the Lord coming on a cloud, but coming into Egypt. He says in verse 2, I will set Egyptians against Egyptians. So it's the destruction of Egypt. Now we see this language in the prophets. Listen to Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man come with the clouds of heaven, and come to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Now again, that's Daniel's description of something going on in heaven. And he's coming with the clouds of heaven. But it's not talking about the second coming. It's talking about something particular that was happening that Daniel saw. And then you see this type of language that involves the elements within this earth. Micah chapter 1 verse 3. Behold, the Lord cometh forth out of his place and will come down. and tread upon the high places of the earth. And the mountains shall be molten under him, and the valleys shall be a cleft or split as wax before the fire, and as the waters that are poured down upon the steep place. Again, that's not talking about the second coming, but it's describing the effect of the Lord coming in judgment. And it says he's coming out of his place. He's coming down. And what he's going to do is tread all the places, even on the earth. And the mountains are melting under him. Then in Joel chapter 2, verse 1, blow ye the trumpet in Zion. Sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble. For the day of the Lord cometh. For it is nigh at hand. Now that's the same kind of thing that we see in Isaiah. The day of the Lord is coming. The day of the Lord is nigh. And he describes the day of the Lord, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and of thick darkness. As the morning spread upon the mountains, a great people and a strong, there have not been ever like, neither shall be any more after it, even to the end, the years of many generations. The earth shall quake before them. The heavens shall tremble, the sun and the moon shall be dark, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. Now that's talking about a judgment in that time. But it's the very language, if you're familiar with the New Testament, that we assume passages are talking about the coming of the Lord when it uses that kind of language. But it's not talking about the end of time. It's not talking about the second coming. Joel goes on, and the Lord shall utter his voice before his army, for the camp is very great. For he is strong and executeth the word, for the day of the Lord is great and very terrible, and who can abide it? And I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. Verse 31, the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before that great and terrible day of the Lord. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be delivered or saved. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance, as the Lord has said, and in the remnant whom the Lord shall call. Now we go to the book of Acts just to answer that. Because in Acts 2, Peter says, this is that. In Acts 2, when the Holy Ghost comes and 3,000 people are converted and the people are hearing, all are hearing these apostles speak in their own languages. They're hearing the apostle is speaking, and the people who speak different languages are understanding it in their language. And Peter says, this is that which was spoken by the prophet Joel. And in verse 19 he says, I will show wonders in heaven above, and signs in the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and notable day of the Lord come. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call the name of the Lord shall be saved. Now you read the book of Acts and you don't see this literally. You don't see this. You see this cloven tongues of fire setting upon people. You see this. You hear the sound of a mighty rushing wind, and you hear these miraculous things of people speaking in languages that they've never spoken or understood in their life. But as far as the sun turned into darkness, the moon into blood, and all of these other things of fire and vapor of smoke and blood, you don't see that. You don't take that as a literal thing. But you're looking at something that's fantastic that happens, and the Bible describes it with these figures. But we don't see a literal fulfillment of them there. As Joel says in chapter 3, verse 15, the sun and the moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. You go to the book of Amos, chapter 8, verse 9. It shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord, that I will cause the sun to go down at noon, and I will darken the earth at broad daylight. Now, that happened at the cross, didn't it? But that isn't what he's talking about in Amos. He's using these figures of extraordinary things happening or the judgment of God, things that we don't find the literal fulfillment, but the figure of God taking all of the universe in hand. So he tells us in Isaiah 24, verse 23, the moon shall be confounded, the sun ashamed, when the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and Jerusalem and before his ancients gloriously. Ezekiel uses the same language in chapter 32, verse 7. And when I shall put thee out, I will cover the heaven and make the stars thereof dark, and I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. That's prophetic language, is all I'm saying. That's consistent in the Old Testament. But this prophetic language is not only in the Old Testament, it's used by our Lord. Matthew 24 is one of the most disputed passages in the New Testament. And it need not be, because what you're dealing with in Matthew 24, you're dealing with, very clearly, the text is asking, these disciples are asking the Lord about the temple. And he says, you see these stones? He said, I'm telling you, in your generation, there won't be one stone left upon another. He talked about the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction that would come in their day. He said, this generation will not pass before this happens. And in 70 AD, 40 years after he said that, it happened just like he said it would happen. In that passage is this prophetic language, and then he uses it concerning his second coming. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn. And they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now that verse there is a verse that scholars are looking at. Is it the prophetic language of the Old Testament? Has he left off talking about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem? Or is he now talking, has he left that and talking about the second coming of Christ? Or is he combining the two? And some believe he does. It's very clear when you get to the 26th chapter, 64th verse of Matthew. Jesus saith unto him, thou hast said, nevertheless I say unto you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of glory. That language is used of the second coming. But it's also used in the Old Testament, the idea of him coming to Egypt that way. Or the idea of what happens when judgment comes to Babylon and to other nations. And one has to look at that and say, is he talking about the second coming particularly? Or is he using that language that the prophets used to talk about the destruction of Jerusalem? Now myself, when I look at Matthew 24, the whole of that passage is so clear that he's talking about the temple that they're walking in. And he's talking about the stones that they're asking him about. And he tells them, every one of these stones are going to be removed from on top of each other. And that's exactly what happened. When the armies of Rome came and they burnt the temple, and these stones, they're getting the gold that had been placed upon the temple. And they have, every stone is removed, one upon the other. And the big thing he says is, this generation will not pass before this happens. He wasn't talking about, there are people that are telling us he's talking about the last 7 years of human history. But it cannot be that he's talking about the last years of human history, because he clearly says, this generation that's alive right now, you, he's telling those disciples, will see it. So we have this language. Now, you go to like 1 Thessalonians 4:17. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so shall we ever be with the Lord. No question. That's the coming of the Lord for his people. Or Revelation 1:7. Behold, he cometh with clouds, and every eye shall see him, and they also which pierced him, and all the kingdoms of the earth shall wail because of him. You may ask, what does it matter, all this you're talking about? And I say it matters this because it infects the interpretation of New Testament passages. And Christianity has long been divided based upon prophecy. And it's the language of the prophets often that causes our problem, how we look at them. And we are looking for literalism. And yet in the Old Testament, over and over again, when they talk about the sun and not shining and the moon not giving us light and blood and all of these other things, it was not talking about the second coming, nor was it a literal fulfillment. But it's looking at judgment as something that affects everything. God's judgment and God turning things, so to speak, upside down. And this passage is important because in the Old Testament, sometimes we have the judgment that is a temporal judgment, like upon Babylon. That will be a judgment that will be seen and has been seen in history. The judgment upon Egypt, it was seen. But oftentimes within that picture, the future day of the Lord. And what we understand, look, wherever you see this kind of judgment in the Old Testament, it is a forelude to the judgment that is to come. If anybody has a quarrel about judgment, and believe you me, a lot of folks have a quarrel about judgment. They can't believe God could judge. In fact, you may be there, and you are a little, you can see the others, but maybe not yourself. But all you need to do is look throughout the Bible, and again, God holds it up. For instance, the flood is held up again for us as a picture of judgment and warning that if God did not spare the old world, what is to keep him from judging the present world? Sodom and Gomorrah becomes a classic picture of the judgment of God and God destroying people. And it's held up for us as a picture of the judgment to come. And here Babylon is held up for us. And in the 19th chapter, Egypt is held up for us. And all you need to do is familiarize yourself with passages like this in the Old Testament. And you'll soon believe in the judgment of God. And it's there to show us the judgment that has happened is very much like the judgment that's going to happen. Well, we look at the prophetic language of the passage, and it's been very interesting to me. I don't say it's been as interesting to others as it is to me. When I did discover that the language that I find in passages like Matthew 24, or the language I find in the book of Revelation, that it's the language of the prophets, then I begin to look at the books and the teachings a little differently. And I say, the language of the prophets was being used, and we need to look at that as the type of language they spoke with. Now, the second thing I want to quickly say, this text, this chapter gives us a biblical view of history. The Bible is the most important history book in the world. It's the only book that doesn't have to be revised. If you're my age and you went to school, that book's been revised quite a bit already. I'm not talking about the revisionist. That certainly is something that's amazing, that we would allow people to do a revision completely on our history. But I'm talking about new discovery, things that are true, things that we know. They change, but the Bible doesn't change. And when I say this gives us a true view of history, here's what I mean. It reveals history that God is superintending. It reveals history that God is providentially controlling. What it does is reveals the sovereign rule of God through history. Now, if you are a history buff, study history, outside of the Bible, you will be forced to study ancient civilizations. You will be forced to study ancient nations. Egypt and Assyria and Babylon, the Chaldeans, the Medes, the Persians, the Alexander the Great, and people like the Romans, of course, the Roman Empire, and all that has succeeded that up until America and the present day. If you then are looking at that in the history books, you're unlikely to get the true picture of what's going on. But if you look at it from the Bible, you will soon know that history is the story of what God has been doing through nations. You will see it, his sovereignty in raising up. For instance, the Bible is very clear that God raises up Pharaoh over the Egyptians. And he does it for a definite purpose. It's very clear that God sent Israel down to Egypt for the definite purpose of his glory when he brought them out of Egypt. That's how the Bible views history. God is moving nations. The Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Assyrian people had a big impact upon the history of the world, but also the history of God's people. And God raises them up. And then there's a time where the prophet cries out, and he's crying out about the evil that's in Israel, and he's saying, Lord, Israel, our people are so wicked. When are you going to do something about it? And God's answer to that prophet, the prophet Habakkuk, is, I'm doing it. If you look, I'm raising up the Babylonians, the Chaldeans. And the prophet can't believe it. He says, the Chaldeans are worse than we are. And God assures him, don't worry, I'll take care of them too. But if you know your Bible and the history of the Bible, you know that the Babylonians were instrumental in the humbling of the people of Israel. The story of Daniel, the story of Jeremiah, the story of Ezekiel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the fiery furnace, the lions, the den of lions, all of that surrounds the nation of Babylon and the people of Israel. And it's all God is working. And then here in this text, he's telling us that I'm going to deal with Babylon. I'm going to overthrow them in verse 19, just like I did Sodom and Gomorrah. And here's how I'm going to do it. I am going to stir up the Medes against them. Now, I don't understand how God does all this. I don't understand all of his dealings, how he moves people's hearts. But I know he does. He moved in the heart of Abraham. And Abraham left his family, began to follow the Lord, and began the journey of faith. God somehow moved upon him. God moved upon Noah, and he builds an ark, and he saves the world. How did he do that? I don't know. But I know he did. And he raised up Pharaoh. He says it very plainly in Romans chapter 9. I raised you up. I raised him up. And he did it for his glory and for his purpose. In fact, the Bible teaches us, that God is responsible for those in places of authority. The Bible is very clear that promotion does not come from the east or the west or from the south, but God raises up one and takes down another. And that's what you're looking at here in this passage. And had I the time, I'd like to take you through a host of verses and show you God's sovereign power over the kingdoms and over the nations and what he is doing. That's what's going on here in this 13th chapter. God is going to deal with Babylon for his purposes. It's very confusing for you and I who are thinking much about the day in which we're living. In fact, if you're thinking much about the day in which you're living, you've got to be a little bit wondering what's going on. Especially when you realize the people who are put into places of power and what they're advocating. And if you and I, our eyes are open at all, we think everything is going against what's right now. And I'm not just talking political, but because abortion has become a political issue. Abortion is a moral issue before God. The homosexual movement in our country. And our children growing up in this time. I was filling out something on the internet yesterday and they want to know how I describe myself. Male or female or other or something. I don't need a list to describe myself. There's only two kinds. There's male and female. That's how God made people. So you and I, here we are, we have the Bible, and we know this nation is killing almost 1 million babies a year. And trying to turn little boys into little girls and girls into boys. And I'm not talking about economics here. I'm not talking about all these philosophies. I'm talking about basic moral issues. And yet we know that those who want to do that in America have been given complete power now to do it. And we're sitting here wondering, where is God? Why does God allow this? Maybe you don't question that. My mind works too much against me, and I have to pray for my mind to not be bothered. But I question sometimes in my mind, why God ever made a world like this? But the Bible said God made everything good, but men have made their own inventions. That's how the Bible describes it. And I think God must have won the people for his name. And the price is worth it to him. And yet, I wonder why. I mean, it just seems that wouldn't you think we would, if God raises up people and people are in power and authority by the command of God, and God raises up nations, and God puts down nations, and God rules the kingdoms of this world. Just put some people in there that will stop this stuff. But it doesn't happen. In reality, I mean, in the end, I have to say that God knows the end from the beginning. And I can't even begin to fathom why he does all what he does. And I don't want to be so arrogant and proud that I sit in judgment on God based upon what limited knowledge I have. Human beings are big about that. I try to think of an illustration that won't set us too much on fire, but just the trial that happened in our community this week, and what Phil was talking right before, and I'm giving my opinion, but reality, I watched 3 or 4 hours of it. 3 or 4 hours of it. I didn't see all the information. Maybe you did, and you agree with it, you disagree with it, but the fact is, me, with 3 or 4 hours of information, I say to myself, should you question what others who have seen everything say? Politics is that way with the leaders of this country, the leaders of the world. They make decisions. And we sit back and we don't understand those decisions. But are we willing to take the position, the great Dr. Lloyd-Jones says, I can't give an opinion on that because I don't have the information they have. Do you understand? And the judgment's all going to sort out. If leaders took us to war and killed innocent people, and they did it for profit, for hidden agendas, they're going to face that one day. That's all in God's. But the truth is, I don't know why. And I watch a little bit here and read a little bit there, and I give you my opinion. And so much of it is just arrogant pride. My opinion is based upon a limited knowledge. And yours is too. And I have to do that with God. I know what the Bible says. I know he rules through history. I know that he lifts up nations and he brings down nations. And I'm like Habakkuk, Lord, where are you? Why don't you deal with Israel? And then when God does deal with Israel, he says, you can't be serious. How can you use Babylon against us? They're worse than we are. And God just has to tell him, so to speak, be patient. You'll see it. And you don't understand it. But what I do understand is I look at the Bible as a view of history that tells me that God raised up Babylon and God took Babylon down. God raised up the Medes and the Persians and God took them down. And God raised up Alexander the Great and God took him down. And God raised up the Roman Empire, and all of these fit into God's plan some way. And he brought them down. Nation, America's future is dependent upon God. Do you believe that? America's future is dependent upon God alone. And I have to rebuke myself where I begin to question. And I begin to allow my wanderings to go too far. And I say, dear God, if I were there, I might would do it different. But who is a fool enough to put his opinion against God's opinion? And God is working. And God knows the end from the beginning. He knows his plan. And this chapter tells me that God's in control. And so finally we come to this statement, this day of the Lord in chapter 13. Because he wants them to know the day of the Lord is at hand, verse 6. Verse 9, the day of the Lord comes. What does it mean? What is the meaning of the day of the Lord? It first means it's his day. It's the day that he has determined. It's the day that he is in absolute charge of. This chapter goes on through chapter 14. And in verse 24 of chapter 14, the Lord of hosts is sworn, saying, surely as I have thought, so it shall come to pass. And as I have purposed, so it shall stand. That's what the day of the Lord means. The day of the Lord means that what God has determined is going to take place. Look at verse 27, chapter 14. For the Lord of hosts has purpose, and who will annul it? His hand is stretched out, and who will turn it back? And then he says, this is the burden which came to pass in the year of King Ahaz died. Well, the year of the Lord, the day of the Lord, rather, is the day that he's determined. So to follow, the Lord is sovereign over the nations. He's sovereign over history. His providence is governing what's going on in America today. But the day of the Lord comes. And it's a day that whatever God has purposed will come to pass. I want to ask you, do you believe that? That whatever God has determined, and you have to decide based upon what the Bible teaches, what he's determined. But once you have determined what he has determined, do you agree that nothing can annul that? What he has determined to do, he will do. And again, I do not begin to understand how all that works out. But I must believe that if I believe the Bible. Not only is it what he has determined and he's absolutely in charge of, that he's guaranteeing the end. It's the day of judgment. Verse 6, wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as a destruction from the Almighty. And verse 9, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, and with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate. Their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. I will punish the world, listen to this, for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud. I will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will make a mortal more rare than fine gold, a man more than the golden wedge of Ophir.
Therefore, I will shake the heavens, and the earth will be moved out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. The day of the Lord is the day of judgment. It's the day, like with Babylon, a temporal judgment. It's the days of history where God brought judgment upon peoples and nations. And let me say individuals. Do you not believe that there are days in this life, apart from the final judgment, apart from the judgment day, that there are individuals that what happens in their life is a judgment from God? And if they could speak, they would say they found out the Lord was in charge, that he was Lord. The day of the Lord is the day of judgment. And so he says in verse 6, it's a day of wailing. It's a day when man's time comes up. Look at verse 22. The hyenas will howl in their citadels, the jackals in their pleasant places. Her time is near to come. And her days will not be prolonged. What he's saying, her time is up. Its time has come up. The day of the Lord is that time when men's time with God has come to the cross point, to the crossroads where they're going to meet God. But if we go a step further and say that the day of the Lord is the day of mercy on his people. Look at verse 1 of chapter 14. For the Lord will have mercy on Jacob and will still choose Israel and settle them in their own land. What he's saying is this, and this is really important to see. You cannot have mercy without having judgment. Do you understand that? You may be here and you're of a liberal mindset about judgment. You may be a liberal mindset about the judgment of criminals. The judgment of criminals is the mercy upon good people. Do you understand that? When you judge evil, you bless good people. Well, I don't think you're making the point, preacher. And I don't think so either, because I'm watching you. It's a simple fact. I was just reading, I think it was this morning, it was last night. There's this morning's news on Fox, on the internet. In a couple different cases, people let out of jail that should not have been let out of jail. And then they go out and kill innocent people. Now, You may be soft and you say, I just hate to see people in prison. I hate to see people. There's a story in there about a school teacher that had molested a 7-year-old child and spent 50 years in prison and died in prison this month. And they constantly were going up on parole trying to get him out, and the family would fight it, and the man dies. And you say, oh, I feel terrible. The man spent 50 years. 50 years in prison is nothing for the mercy of other little children that man might have destroyed. You see, his judgment was mercy to other people. Do you see that? And that's what he's saying here. The judgment of Babylon, which was thorough. The judgment of Babylon was like that of Sodom and Gomorrah. But when Babylon was judged, a lot of other people found mercy because Babylon would have been destructive to them. You cannot be for the good and the welfare and mercy for people and at the same time an open door to those people who would destroy good people. Hell itself, listen to me, hell itself will be a mercy to good people who just want to live a good, quiet life. If we had the justice of God, exercise continually. You think you'd have to lock your doors at night and carry guns with you all the time and lock your car at the church door. The truth of it is that the judgment of evil people is the mercy of God upon good people. You've got to see that. The most troubling thing to me, one of the most troubling things to me is when I read and when I study and I read too much news, I'll grant you I do. But when I find that some soft judge or lawmakers have made laws that let evil people back on the street. And it's a fact. Listen, if somebody has molested children, they'll do it again. If they've raped people, they'll do it again. Aside from the new birth in Jesus Christ, I know of nothing that's successful at changing people who in their heart are bent to evil. And so we find ourselves saying, well, you're spouting conservative. I'm spouting what the Bible is clearly showing here. Chapter 14 is tied to chapter 13. Chapter 13 is nothing but the judgment of Babylon, whose day has come, whose day is at hand, whose time is up. And the destruction of the Almighty has come upon Babylon. And he immediately begins to talk about the mercy now that's going to be showed to Jacob. Because Babylon has been the enemy of Jacob. The day of the Lord is the day of mercy, is what I'm trying to say. And yet you, how do you see it? Do you see the great white throne? You see the judgment seat, the sheep and the goats, and the sheep are placed to the right, and the goats to the left, and the sheep taken into the eternal kingdom, and the goats cast away from God forever. And there's more on the left than on the right. But that group on the right has lived their days tormented, so to speak, by that group on the left. Because of evil. The evil of the world as it is. And the great final judgment of God will be mercy. Even the destruction of the wicked is a mercy to the people of God. And finally, the day of the Lord is ultimately the day of the coming of the Lord. And you can read this in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 5, 2 Corinthians. It's there in 1 Thessalonians. It's all through the Bible, 5, verse 2. The day of the Lord, as he says in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, the day of the Lord will come. The day of the Lord here in the 13th chapter is the day of the destruction of Babylon. But ultimately, the day of the Lord is the coming of the glory of the Lord, the coming revelation of Jesus Christ. And the prophet, this term is what I'm talking about, the day of the Lord. When you move over into the New Testament, that same figure stands for the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, coming in the clouds, coming in glory, coming to reward his own, coming to judge the world, coming to establish righteousness, coming to establish that great eternal day. And that's what you and I are prayerfully looking for. Before that day comes, you and I may see the day of the Lord come for America. There is no guarantee that the Lord is coming in your lifetime. You and I are to live as though he could come at any time. But all Christians of all days have lived in light of the coming of the Lord. And you and I live that way. But until then, our God will raise up nations and bring nations down. Our God will do things that we don't understand. Our God will act in ways that are beyond our comprehension. But it's all finally coming to that great day of the Lord. That day that began with his first coming and is anticipating his second coming. And what the Bible would tell us is to live as people who are living in light of that day. And the Bible would tell us to prepare for that day. For you know not the day nor the hour that your Lord has come. Live as though it may be today. Let's stand together.